but Ben, no devotee of physical contact, converted it into a handshake. Holding on tight, the good monk hustled him toward the door. "Out we go," he grinned at an open-mouthed Ben, who began to protest as the door closed on him. "Tony and I want to be alone." He turned to me and gave me the hug instead, then a smacky kiss on the cheek, as if we'd known each other for years. "What terrible weather you've brought with you, my dear." He gathered his skirts around his knees and plopped into the only armchair. "But it's always remarkably wet in Holy Week. Then on Easter Sunday, out comes the sun." He had a hurried, eager, very English manner of speech, his R's always threatening to become V's. I went to kneel beside the chair, as I had with Father Bleary when he heard my confession in his lair. No, said Father Joseph Warrilow 17 times. "Sit down next to me." He reached over for a little wooden stool at the table and pulled it to him, patting the seat. I sat down. Without looking at me, he took my hand in his, big, surprisingly soft, and held it on the arm of the chair. His long, mobile lips pursed and unpursed several times. He blinked rapidly until finally his eyes closed. Evidently, it was his way of concentrating his energies. His hand relaxed slightly over mine, and I began to feel its warmth. The intimacy took me aback, but I was drawn in by something stronger. There was a stillness in the room, the same stillness I'd noticed earlier when we'd arrived, this time without any apprehension. A calm suffused me, a physical sensation running through my body like a hot drink on a cold night. For the first time in a week, all my fears melted away. "Now, dear," he said, eyes still closed, "tell me everything." So I did. I told him how Lily and I had met, how it had started, where it had started, the things she said to me, the things I said to her, the kissing, the existential silences, our deception of Ben, the dinginess of the trailer, Gallic versus Teutonic, the religious indoctrination, the parallels with Graham Greene, everything I could think of. His lips continued to work, pursing and unpursing. Occasionally there was a flurry of blinking, but his eyes stayed closed as he listened without comment or prompt, concentrating on every aspect of what I had to say, as if he were meditating as I spoke, murmuring, "Yes, yes, yes," from time to time, his whole knobbly, lopsided body focused on my story. When I came to the parts that had made me privately laugh, or had seemed absurd, he smiled and nodded, but didn't laugh. The only time he frowned was when I threw in a self-castigating mea culpa, as if this was an irrelevant intrusion into the narrative. Inevitably, we came to the part I dreaded, the breaking point, the unhappy ending. My adulterous eyes on the breasts of another man's wife. My adulterous hands under her dress. My adulterous fingers inching their way into another man's wife's vagina. To my complete surprise, this didn't seem to merit a different response from anything else I'd said. His lips went on working, his eyes, as always, closed. They didn't purse or unpurse at any greater tempo, or blink any more rapidly. None of it seemed to warrant any of the shock or horror I had anticipated. And so my tale was done. A beat of silence, his busy face at rest. "Poor Lily," he murmured. It drifted across my mind as he sat there saying nothing further that this had been a cue. He'd gotten me to open up, now, wham, punishment! The door swinging open. Younger, tougher monks pulling me to my feet. Even as the fatuous thought passed into the limbo of fatuous thoughts, I knew I'd just met a man from whom would come none of the usual responses I'd learned to expect from priests. Some unknown fuel drove his engine. Gentleness bubbled out from the funny figure in the scruffy black robes, like clear water from solid rock. It was flowing into me through his dry, warm hand. I felt on the brink of learning an entirely new set of possible responses to the world. He hadn't questioned a thing I'd said. He hadn't asked me to repeat or clarify, or was I sure that so-and-so had happened, or that I hadn't left something important out. He seemed to assume that I was telling the truth, which I'd tried to the limit of my ability to do, or he knew by instinct that my account could be trusted. That alone was remarkable. No authority figure had ever failed to question me directly or indirectly about any account I'd ever given of anything. Adolescent life is governed by cross-examination. When he finally spoke, his words were slow and stilted, his face beginning to work again, as if he were trying to puzzle out what was being said to him by someone speaking to him through a spiritual earpiece. "You've done nothing truly wrong, Tony dear. God's love has brought you here before any real harm could be done. The only sin you've committed is the sin of selfishness." The soft, hesitant emphasis on the word made it quite clear he regarded this as a far more serious crime than the one that was officially on the charge sheet. The verdict was gentle, final. The last word of, well, a father. A father unlike mine or anyone's I knew. Unlike the men we were accustomed to call father, or even, according to all reports, the God we called father. I'd confided something that had confused and tormented and terrified me to this father, and the matter had been handled. "You won't see her for a while, will you, dear? Not alone, anyway. It wouldn't be fair to her." I nodded, swept by waves of relief, then by a new consternation, that I'd never once considered the pain of a hungry, trapped, unhappy woman. Yes, selfishness. Lily came into sharp focus. I saw her anguished, longing face, a real person with a real inner life, whom I'd treated as a mere extension of my nerve endings, a prop for my young posturings on the stage of adulthood. For the first time, I felt toward her something like love, or at least the gentleness I owed her. How had he done that? He murmured the words of absolution and made a tiny cross on my forehead with a big long thumb. "No penance. I think you've already done a good deal of penance, haven't you?" He shot me a little grin, sidelong and conspiratorial. And how did he know that? He got up awkwardly, and a fuss of departure began, words tumbling out of him in his funny, rushing prattle. I didn't want him to go. I'd never felt so safe and secure with anyone in my life. I wanted to tell him everything that had ever happened in my few years. There were a million things I wanted to ask him. No, 2 million. He'd been with me only 5 or 10 minutes, for heaven's sake. I realized later that it had been nearly 3/4 of an hour. "Can't you stay a bit, Father?" He chortled. "I'd love to, my dear. I'm a night owl. If they'd let me, I'd talk all night. But these old bones must be up at the crack of dawn for vigils. Now don't you try and come like these others, silly things. It's much too early for sensible people. We'll see each other again and talk and talk. God bless you, my dear." Again the hug. Again the swirl of skirts. Again the super sandals squeaking away down the linoleum. Then silence and peace. Chapter 5. The next day was Good Friday, the holiest day in the Catholic calendar, the commemoration of Christ's death, a day of fasting, penitence, and prayer. I woke very late in the morning. I must have been out for 13 or 14 hours. There was no one in the guest house, the church, the porter's lodge. I assumed everyone was in super-holy mode and retired to my room to read. Ben appeared for lunch, but he avoided my eye and hurried away afterward. The same happened at the afternoon service and at the evening meal. I put it down to piety rather than pique, all the other guests, especially the monk groupies, being in a state of advanced solemnity. I was too, in some fashion. I always enjoyed Holy Week. The Passion and Crucifixion are great stories, full of action, arrest, good guys, bad guys, conflicted guys, Pilate, Peter, double crosses, Judas, the Jerusalem mob, and R-rated violence, flogging, torture, the carrying of the cross, and ending with a spectacular death scene, all the more gripping because the good guy dies. The whole mise-en-scene made more authentic by brilliant narrative touches, like Veronica offering Jesus the cloth to wipe his face, the soldiers dicing for his robe under the cross, and the bad thief crucified beside Jesus, who tells the Savior of the universe to get lost, which I always thought took real guts, far more than the obsequious good thief, who had nothing to lose. One was supposed to be sad and penitent on Good Friday, but I always felt cheerful and turned on, as if I were actually part of a biblical epic, complete with Israelites in flowing robes, and Romans in brass skirts, and people shouting lines at each other in temples and tents. What I was focused on this Good Friday was, when would I next get to see Father Joseph Warrilow? At the services I went to, I couldn't spot him in the serried ranks of monks, and I worried that this might be because I'd taken away a mistaken image of him the night before, and now couldn't recognize him. After minimal human contact all day, I finally tracked down the old monk just before bedtime. Could he ask my new friend when I might see him again? Snappishly, he replied that Father Joseph had many duties and other guests to worry about, and music to rehearse for Easter Sunday. Apparently he was also the organist for the community, which is why I hadn't seen him in the church. He was out of sight in the organ loft. But he would convey my message to Father Joseph if humanly possible, which I took to mean, provided same was not up a substantial number of steps. The next day was Holy Saturday, as uneventful a day as Good Friday is packed with action, since Jesus is now dead. According to Catholic tradition, he kept busy nonetheless, descending into hell for the harrowing of it, the release of good men and women who had had the misfortune to live before he made salvation available. Still, nothing happens in the church, which is empty, stripped of its usual furnishings, its decorations concealed by funereal purple cloth. It was the middle of the morning, and I was bored. Ben was once again nowhere to be found. I didn't feel like meditating on the meaning of Easter, and the books in the guest room were either painfully academic or nauseatingly pious. I was used to physical activity, walking or cycling or exploring the countryside, and there was nowhere to be active except the enclosure in front of the monastery, which was fine for the other guests, whose idea of aerobic exercise was pulling a cigarette from its box, but left me restless and tetchy. I had been told we were only a few hundred yards from the sea, but I didn't know how to get to it. It was a wild, windy day, the kind I love. I peered through the tiny panes of my window at the racing clouds and cavorting trees, and felt very left out. I wasn't sure about this place. Music? Definitely okay. Father Joseph Warrilow? More than okay. Otherwise, monastic life seemed like a gentlemanly version of jail. All of a sudden, that squeak of sandal on lino, that swoosh of skirts, and there he was in the doorway, ears as big as before, feet as flat. I hadn't exaggerated my image of him at all. He was funny-looking enough to make you smile whenever he made an entrance. Before I could stop myself, I was laughing. "Dear Tony, sorry to be late. I do so love the organ. It's hard to tear myself away. How about a walk? It's wild and windy today. My favorite weather." He thrust his arm through mine, and off we went down the stairs, out into the enclosure, and through one of the huge gates marked Private. Tranquil and rustic though Cor appeared from the entrance area, there was no way to guess at the full beauty of its surroundings. The gate marked Private was the door into a secret Eden. A broad earthen path ran beside the church and past a tiny cemetery containing rows of plain stone crosses, then through massive oaks to curve round a great sweep of newly ploughed fields, brown and soft against the wild blue and grey sky. disappearing into a grove of horse chestnuts and dense woods of moroak, beyond which heaved the turbulent, white-capped Solent. Off to the right, in a lush, sea-level meadow, were scattered the ruins of an early 12th century Cistercian monastery, where white-robed monks had once tended their ancestors, a flock of sheep chomped on grass, rooted in their shepherd's remains. It took my breath away. The curve of the great path, the contrasts of raw earth against rushing cumulus, of tumbled old stone against tall young grass, of leaf-speckled oaks against the sea. A very different landscape than my placid, green-shaded Hertfordshire. This was impeccable and classic, every element of natural beauty in exact harmony. A foretaste of perfection, an amuse-bouche of paradise. It had the dignity of a mighty painting, but I felt in it and of it. I knew this place. I had read about it in a poem, or dreamed it once. I stopped, and he did too, our arms still linked, his eyes doing their signature blink, his rodent nose twitching with pleasure in the swirling air. "Oh, yes, dear. Yes, yes, yes. Whenever I come round this corner, I'm sure I'm seeing it for the very first time." We walked down the wide path to the grove of horse chestnuts. They were in bloom, their conical flowers scattered like massive Christmas candles in the boughs. As most English schoolboys did, I played conkers, a conker being the large, smooth, mahogany-coloured nut of this tree. You'd make a hole in the middle of your conker, then suspend it from a piece of knotted string about a foot long. Conkers was played by two boys. You took turns holding up your conker by the string, while the other guy took a shot at smashing it, using his conker like a miniature mason chain. If he shattered your conker with his conker, he won the bout. If not, you got a shot at his. The skill of the game came in selecting the right conker. Large nuts were not always desirable, since they split easily, and in wielding your nut so that it came down with maximum force on the other guy's nut. The ultimate aim was to own a conker that had racked up an impressive number of kills. A fiver had murdered five other nuts, a tenner ten, and so on. You were supposed to use only the current year's conkers in their natural state, but unscrupulous players would toughen theirs by cooking them in a low oven, or soaking them in vinegar, or, lowest of the low, using last year's nuts. I was a bit old for the game itself, but no English male worth his salt could pass under a chestnut tree without assessing its conker potential. These trees looked very promising, young and robust. "There'll be some terrific conkers under here in a few months," I said. "There will indeed," he replied. "They give wonderful conkers." He searched the ground as we walked. "There's one." He picked up a medium-sized nut from under some leaves. It must have lain in a dry place, for instead of being soft and rotten, it was wizened and hard as a rock. "A beauty." He tapped it with a practiced knuckle. "At least a tenner or twelver." "But, Father, it's from last year. You can't use that." The venerable monk shot me a rubbery, naughty boy grin. "Who says I can't?" He pocketed the conker. The path came to a little promontory. The sea heaved and tugged at the soggy shoreline below, the wind whipping spume off the chop further out. Across the Solent, you could see the smudge of Portsmouth, which had been a major naval facility in World War II, and in every war for centuries back. We stood arm in arm, still, gazing at the far-off mainland. It seemed much farther than 2 miles away, and getting farther by the minute. He blinked and closed his eyes meditatively. "A world away." "I'm not sure I want to go back, Father Warlow." The eyes blinked, the lips pursed. "Oh, but you must, dear." Suddenly, gusts of wind ripped round us, whipping his robes up around his thighs. He yanked his arm from mine, trying clumsily to hold down his skirts. Marilyn Monroe would do much the same over a subway grate in New York City later that year, but she couldn't come close to him in the knobbly English knees department. Finally, he got his wayward garb under control, spluttering, "Oh, my goodness! Oh, my goodness!" "Well," he laughed, "now that you've seen my knees, you can hardly call me Father Wallilo." "What should I call you, then?" "Everyone calls me Joe." A bit radical, I thought. This monk did nothing that other priests did. He talked to me like an equal, not a sinner, and so far had made no mention of that ultimate sanction used by all Catholic adults, hell. But still, he was a priest. "How about Father Joe?"
"Father Joe, it is."
He retucked his arm through mine, and back we went through the wind-whipped woods. I don't remember everything we talked about that wild spring morning, but it was life-changing in ways I could never have conceived, when I'd stood 2 days earlier, churning with fear, at the end of the driveway. There was plenty to discover as we ambled down muddy paths, through meadows of fat cattle, around fields of winter crops, beneath more mighty oaks, circumnavigating Core Abbey's extensive farm, all 200 acres of it, for an hour or more. Father Joe had been a monk for 30 years, having become one at 17, which made him several years older than my father. But I wouldn't have pegged him as my father's senior. It wasn't his appearance. He could have been 30 or 60. It was more that he was in tune with, or appropriating my rhythms. He followed my sequence of thoughts. He didn't have to explain his terms to me, nor I mine to him. He really did appear to perceive things as a young man might, to be seeing, hearing, thinking things for the first time. The incessant workings of his face marshaled his responses. But what in another could have been a means of controlling the dialogue seemed in him quite unconscious. He gave one the feeling that his experience of any stimulus, a bird on the bough, a chance meeting, an idea he must have heard 100 times, had never been quite the same before, nor would be again. This one time, and hence the person he was talking to, was utterly unique. He hailed from Essex, with the usual Irish antecedents that make English people Catholic. But he couldn't have looked more English, and therefore, to me, Protestant. When later I began to study Piers Plowman, I instinctively projected his bony, asymmetrical face onto that English archetype, an early harbinger of the Reformation. But he had a very un-English lack of inhibition, and an even more un-English love of the French. He'd spent the first part of his career at another French-founded Benedictine monastery called Farnborough, but in some internal monastic politics had been transferred to Core. He'd flourished in these French microclimates. "Such an expressive language, don't you think, dear? It comes off the tongue like honey. Or vinegar, depending on what you're saying. You must do French at school. I expect you speak it very well." My French was appalling. I hated its regimented grammar and impossible obsession with genders. But I was fully prepared to give it a second chance, on his say-so. "And the cooks here. Ah, Tony, dear, we've been fasting all week, but just you wait till tomorrow. And of course," his granny glasses in my face, eyes shining with undisguised Epicurean lust, "there'll be wine." "If you love French things, you must have a Gallic temperament, like Lily."
"I don't think Lily has a Gallic temperament, dear. I don't think she thinks so, either. I think she has a very Catholic temperament."
Startling. For me, absent, glaring evidence to the contrary, adult self-description was always to be taken ex cathedra. "What about Ben, then? Do you think he has a Teutonic temperament?"
"Good heavens, no. Ben's as British as steak and kidney pie. It's just his way of controlling his feelings, you see. And Lily's feelings, too, of course.
He'd had a good talk with Ben the night before, and would have one with Lily within the week. That would mean, best of all, he would get to meet her little baby. I was dimly aware that there were other mea culpas than my own in this triangle. Indeed, I would have been delighted to have this confirmed. But I was also learning that I would never know for sure. Father Joe had nothing bad to say to others about those who consulted him, however much he might have found fault with them in private, which only augmented your trust. Anyone who blames the other party to your face blames you to theirs. Being a monk, he spoke of God, but rarely unless linked with the word love. And while he spoke of God as he, it wasn't a he I recognized at all, that far-off, knee-weakening authority, headmaster of the universe, invoked to enforce discipline or morality or compliance with doctrine. Father Joe didn't appear to need the clerical metal ruler of "do it or I'll tell your father." The he of his God was gentle, generous, endlessly creative, musical, artistic, an engineer and architect of genius. A he who felt his joy and your joy deeply, who could be hurt just as deeply, but would never give up on you, who showered you with gifts and opportunities, whether you acknowledge them or not, who set you tasks, but didn't abandon you if you failed them. Often, in fact, he fit much better into my 50s-shaped notion of she. Father Joe spoke of this person fondly and gratefully, with respect, but more than a hint of intimacy. Familiarity for him had bred no contempt. Fear wasn't even on the board. His God might have untold trillions of other concerns, but definitely had time to be Father Joe's best friend. And there was something else, which I realized later as I went over and over every detail and impression of that walk. Unlike the pious, he didn't speak of Christ very much. But then, neither did Christ. Soon we were strolling through an orchard, and the considerable extent of the monastery was apparent above the trees. We passed its working areas, wood shop, metal shop, leather shop, garages, repair facilities, barns and granaries, dairy, bakery, kitchens, places to produce sustenance of all kinds, places which in the outside world are redolent of obligation and tedium and exploitation and discontent. But here were embraced as prayer, another and very different form of sustenance. We came to the other great gate marked private. Father Joe hauled it open and held my hand for a long moment in his big warm one. He would not see me again, he said. The demands of the Easter liturgy were great, and we were leaving the next day, Easter Sunday, after lunch. He hugged me tight and again gave me the smacky kiss on the cheek, which I now knew was a time-honored Benedictine custom, the kiss of peace. The exit door to Eden closed on the black, flapping figure. Chapter 6. Lavabo inter innocentes manus meus. Father Bleary turned towards me, his baggy face speckled with dried blood from a hurried shave in an ill-lit bathroom. What little hair he had, the color of wet rat fur, his meaty old Celtic mitts shaking from the whiskey which had briefly kept death and failure and despair at bay the night before. He could hardly hold the tips of his thumbs and index fingers together over the chalice as I poured water on them from a little glass flask. As always, his head slumped a bit over the task. Then he lifted it to continue reading. Here it came, the breath of death. Et sacrum dabo altore tuum, Domine. It was always that dabo and Domine that did it. The D syllables releasing fetid waves of long-dead dinners fermenting in his gums. I welcomed it with a joyful prayer of thanks. I gratefully inhaled the horrible stink, offering my selfless nostrils up to God for the unfortunate souls languishing in purgatory, my saintly sacrifice knocking several centuries of torment off the meter for some long-dead sinner. The lavabo, literally, I will wash, was the beginning of Act Two of the Mass, the good part, where the action kicked in, the big magic began to happen. The ancient Latin words never failed to scare up a cloud of butterflies in my now 15-year-old belly. I accepted without question that the wobbly heap of scrofulous humanity in the threadbare robes was a vital link in a mighty chain that stretched from our dingy little sanctuary back down 20 centuries of courage, wickedness, conflict, sanctity, high art, arrogance, generosity, savagery, creativity, suffering, ecstasy, humility, hypocrisy, scholarship, and self-sacrifice, to another dingy little public place, where another young man gave his friends a farewell supper, knowing that in 3 days his Roman masters would crucify him. And through the power invested in the wobbly heap, not only was that farewell supper commemorated here almost 20 centuries later, but the young man himself, Jesus of Nazareth, Messiah, Savior of mankind, Son of the Father, second person of the Trinity, would in a few minutes enter the wafer that lay between those cracked and dirty fingernails, the living, throbbing presence of God. I believed it all now. It all made perfect sense. Ben's crystalline theological theorems had fit nicely together, like the hexagonal representations of molecules in my chemistry diagrams, clustering around the central molecule of belief in the existence of God. From this and the concomitant existence of evil, lines connected to all the other molecules of faith, the necessity of redemption, the incarnation, the crucifixion and resurrection, the apostolic succession, the Church's labyrinthine and gargantuan tax system for salvation, the Eternal Revenue Service. But I never believed Ben's diagram. It was all on paper, abstract, removed from the continuum of time and space in which one talked, walked, studied, admired the scenery, ate, drank, pissed, shat, and most important, sinned. It was true only in some parallel dimension, the dimension of religion. It had never been real. Not until Easter Sunday, the morning after my walk with Father Joe. Like the rest of Holy Week, Easter is also a terrific story. It starts as tragedy, the hero broken and bloody, against all expectation dead, his followers' joyful hope in him entombed with his corpse, the rock rolled into place, sealing their despair. But the curtain doesn't fall there. The next morning at dawn, they discover the rock has been rolled back. The tomb is empty. The body's gone. A missing corpse? Great stuff. A whisper of comedy. Now a touch of farce, as Mary Magdalene and the guys chase frantically around, looking for help or the corpse, when suddenly, out of nowhere, up it pops. Alive. Of course, it's Jesus, who's done the impossible and beaten death. And they're so amazed, they think he's the gardener. It's a payoff way beyond the Hollywood ending. All the flooding emotion and uplift of a tragedy, followed by all the bubbling joy and optimism of a comedy. Is that possible? Not just to live happily ever after, but to die, and still live happily ever after. It's the most audacious claim of Christianity, the one element that marks the brand indelibly, that trumps the claims of all other major faiths. And of course, I'd never really believed it either. The resurrection was in that same parallel dimension, an amazing trick performed by the character Jesus in a gripping story. Like those Disney characters, Pinocchio or Snow White, who would die or be murdered, and utter despair would grip the enchanted kingdom, until suddenly, by some agency, bingo! Their thyroidal eyes come slowly open, their pallid faces break into a smile, the strings swell, the massed voices soar, and death has no dominion. I'd never considered any of my religion's great stories to be actually, factually true. As true as the eggs in the nest in spring, the sticky green lumps pushing from the dead branches, things I could see and stroke, and know their actuality, the outward signs of inner grace. Nor had I ever met a man or woman true in that sense, as natural and simple as the eggs and buds, beneath whose untidy exterior pulsed that same evidence of the divine. But now I had. As I sat in the Abbey Church that Easter Sunday, the morning after our first walk, the sun flooding through the chancel windows, he'd been right about that too, the triumphant Alleluia of Easter bursting from every phrase of the chant, the music pure and odd and unique, its tonalities never going quite where Occidental ears would expect. Another sacrament, in fact, alive with divine promise. It suddenly struck me, for the first time in my life, that the Easter story was not just a story. It had actually happened in this dimension, the one I existed in, the here and now, or the there and then. This morning had been celebrated a mere 1,923 times. 1956 minus 33 for Christ's age. It wasn't an enormous number of times when you thought about it. Approximately the number of pounds Dad earned in a good year. A graspable, tangible figure from which you could count backward, pausing to get your bearings over historical blips like the French Revolution or the discovery of America or the fall of Rome, until there you were, back at zero, and it was actually happening. Early one morning, in a city called Jerusalem, which was still there at the other end of the Mediterranean, just 1,923 of these mornings ago, a woman and two men rushing wildly around the burial ground, looking for their friend's body, and bumping into the gardener. Which brought Christ into focus, too. He wasn't just the hero of a great yarn, or the quad erat demonstrandum of a neat syllogistic proof, and probably not the doe-eyed soap star of the soppy statues, either. But a man, alive, perhaps as odd as Father Joe, untidy and uneven, exuding gentleness and peace, with sandals larger than you'd expect, or funny-looking, with a big nose or ears, someone you would mistake for the gardener, an actual, factual guy, walking, talking, eating, drinking, shitting, pissing, just like us, in the everyday miracle of an ordinary human body. And what if this singular man, in some unprecedented, unrepeatable way, was in touch with the divine? Was divine as claimed? Which, with the evidence of Father Joe before me, did not seem quite so outrageous a claim as before. What if the story of the resurrection was actually, factually true? Not just an extra crowd-pleasing narrative twist, but a once-in-the-planet's-lifetime occurrence, designed to demonstrate that there was hope after death, and that the resurrectee was everything he said he was. Then the world and the universe would be totally different places. True good might even be attainable in life, as well as the self-evident evil. If one part of it was true, why not all of it? The lines of force on Ben's diagram, which had connected to all the other big doctrines, flashed from unconvincing black and white to living color. In the monastery church, the stately Latin sonorities of the Mass were reaching their climax in one of those big doctrines, the transubstantiation. Soon, the fragile flour and water wafer would become the flesh of Christ, confining within its fraction of an ounce the infinite dimensions of something beyond universes and event horizons, behind and above all existence. What had been baffling claptrap all my life suddenly became more than a proposition. It became true and real. I felt a welling, overflowing excitement in the perception that God existed, and therefore, so did I. As I took the host a few minutes later, all the conflicting and confusing thoughts and feelings I normally experienced, the usual objections and reservations and logical, sensible, common-sense hesitancies, were swept aside, fused into a whole of certainty. It was all perfectly natural. It all made perfect sense. This was bread just as Christ had used bread. This was a meal just as the Last Supper had been. How else would you take your God into yourself but through your mouth, consuming him in this ordinary, mundane way? The ordinary was the divine, where common sense met mystery, where logic kissed the cheek of the inexplicable. The immeasurable, immemorial spirit, throbbing like veins beneath the hard gray asphalt of quotidian life. What had always bothered and often panicked me, the wafer sticking to the roof of my mouth and having to be poked and peeled away sacrilegiously with the tip of my tongue, was welcome now, intended, a way to savor its nature before its material vehicle dissolved. The host practically burned my mouth with the presence of what it contained. I felt as if a shaft of light had pierced the top of my cranium and lit me up from the inside out. As Mass ended, I ran from the church, unable to contain myself any longer, shoving aside the startled Catholics. I banged through the huge gate marked private, and ran past the massive oaks, down the great path, through the sweeping blossom-dappled chestnuts, to the white-capped sunlit sea. I danced as I ran, yelled whatever came into my head, bits of songs, schoolboy whoops, Latin tags. I flung myself around in mad pirouettes. I tried to run up the trunks of trees. I began to scramble down the muddy promontory overlooking the Solent, and gave it up, jumping the last 15 feet or so and crashing in a heap on the pebbles, feeling nothing. I tore along the beach as if I was doing a victory lap, a happy champion, happier than I could ever remember being. Truth existed, and so did I. I was real. Me, a me, not an idea or a possibility, or someone else's incomplete theorem, or a mutinous bundle of neurons. The lunch was excellent, Father Joe proving to be right yet again. And there was wine, the first red wine I'd ever tasted, which I was allowed to pour myself as much as I liked. I felt no regret as Ben and I walked away from Core Abbey, down the driveway, back toward the world. Whose voice, or what part of me, I wondered, had warned me not to go up that driveway? Did the voice know how cataclysmic was the change that awaited me up there? That I would find at Core not just a sanctuary, an Eden, but most precious of all, a home. There was no need for regret. I would be back, and right speedily. Everything had changed, too, between Ben and me, as we followed the interminable bus, ferry, train, subway, train, bus rigmarole back across the south of England. He was subdued and reticent, far from his usual declamatory self. I got the feeling the visit had not been at all as he intended or expected. Once in a while, I caught him actually looking at me, instead of his pal on the horizon, as if he were trying to puzzle out why I was so bright and cheerful when I ought to be dour and penitential. Even his iron Teutonic carapace could hardly fail to detect that something had happened to me. I felt like a spiritual version of Roadrunner, zooming past Wily Bootle as he assembled a complex gadget in the road to slow me down or sabotage me.
I said how great Father Joseph was, how saintly. Saintly wasn't quite the word I wanted, but I couldn't think of a better one.
Yes, he's wonderful, agreed Ben, but intellectually slight.
I didn't really hear this till later. It was so far off my meter, it didn't register. In any case, I'd borrowed a book by the great Benedictine historian Dom David Knowles from the guest room, and was completely engrossed in it. Ben made approving noises at this studious choice, but I didn't much care what he thought. I was tearing through it, soaking it up like a sponge. I think Ben knew he'd lost his pupil. When we parted outside my house, he asked whether I'd be down for my usual Tuesday evening instruction, and I said, "No, Father Joseph thinks Lily and I shouldn't see each other for a while." An odd, confused expression crossed his face. This was something his calculus ought to have predicted, but hadn't.
"Well, I'll get rid of her for the evening,"
he said, with a stab at manly jocularity. I saw Lily's small, pale face in the gloaming, as she pushed the baby's pram toward the village on some trumped-up errand, knowing full well why she'd been sent away. "I don't think so," I said, and the last page of that volume turned, and it was over. The glow of Cor did not fade. I'd always been a creature of crazes. I was aware of this, and often depressed by it. Not that that stopped them from coming. I'd measured the effective life of my crazes. They averaged 3 weeks. I'd been an astronomer, archaeologist, research chemist, brewer and vintner, race car mechanic, minimalist poet, twice, numismatist, lepidopterist, reporter, concert pianist, angler, munitions expert, operatic tenor, Olympic track and field star, lumberjack, and spelunker. These were more than mere hobbies. They were all-consuming, full-blown passions. When a craze bit me, I devoured data for days, right away for free information, and project myself furiously into the role, babbling newfound expertise as I conducted crucial field tests. Since these always involved equipment or raw materials, and I had no funds, elaborate improvisation would have to take place. As astronomer, I found a pair of binoculars in the attic and hacksawed them apart for the lenses, which I glued into an old drainpipe. I never did get a very clear view of Saturn, but Fred Hoyle and I had some furious debates, all of which I won. As brewer, I fermented every plant in the garden, from nettles to lichen, making my sister quite sick when she mistook a toadstool stout for cold tea. Munitions expert meant nicking nitrates from the farmer down the lane and sugar from the larder, and leaving a gaping hole in the back of the garage. Spelunker, in the flat clay of Hertfordshire, meant actually digging my own caverns, with disastrous results for the same farmer's tractor when it rolled over one of them. The 3 week life of my enthusiasms had a lot to do with the limits of my ingenuity, or getting sidetracked for days trying to come up with a working version of an indispensable piece of equipment. No lepidopterist can function without a butterfly net. His mum's old bra just will not do. A little voice sneered that Cor too was a craze, and would fade within the regulation period. But I desperately didn't want it to, and as the weeks rolled by, I grew more confident that this time was different. Like all my other teen dreams, the new identity was like a tailor's fitting, as I turned this way and that to see how it looked in the mirror of self-consciousness. But unlike the others, it was more than an inwardly directed choice that for the moment felt right. There was an outwardly directed component this time, a new way of looking at the world around me that also felt right and made sense, indeed transformed it. The sheer force of my experience at Cor, this new grasp of the realness of things, lit up unexpected areas of my life.
areas I'd preferred to ignore or endure up till then. History, once my most and then my least favorite subject, resumed center stage. It had become a tedium to study, a forgettable rat's nest of dates and places and people, every one of them stone-cold dead and of no relevance to me here and now. Just as Latin was a dead language, history was a dead subject. I asked Mum once why we had to belong to such an incredibly old religion. Weren't there any new ones? She didn't agree or disagree, but she did give me a lurid pamphlet the Jehovah's Witnesses had left behind. Now, driven by the need to dig farther, and just as urgently to experience the actuality of everything I could, history became my new frontier. The past became my future, a vast terra incognita, every discovery of which was another chunk of virgin territory I could claim, bringing with it the glow of ownership, the anticipatory thrill of further exploration. Wars and treaties and royals still bored me silly, but how real people lived and thought, what they had done with their hands and minds, obsessed me, and when I got a flash of what it might have been, cheered me in some obscure but wonderful way. History was a way to live extra lives, to cheat the limits of flesh and blood, to roll the rock back from the tomb and free the resurrected dead. Of none was this truer than of the Benedictines, my new heroes, my men in black. And there was plenty to know. It was a tradition so deep, you never heard the stone hit bottom. Almost anywhere in England, or Europe for that matter, you ran up against the Benedictine legacy, whether it was simply a place name or something embedded deeper in the culture, like the bottle of Nuit Saint-Georges my father treated himself to at Christmas, or the university colleges I was being urged to start thinking about. Right under my nose was the most obvious example of all, my own school, a Benedictine monastery from its foundation in 793 until the dissolution of the monasteries in 1539. So far, St. Albans School had been for me, well, a school, an unexceptional late 19th century complex of assembly hall, corridors, labs, classrooms, etc., whose dominant features were a big central bulletin board, where you found out your end-of-term marks, or whether you were on a school team, and various nooks and crannies where cigarettes could be frantically sucked on. The library was housed in a medieval gateway. It was built, in the old style, of flint. But so were many official buildings in that part of England. Nearby was a large Protestant church, of little interest to me since Catholics were excluded from it during prayers and services. The outlines of ancient stone structures were scattered about the lawns. Their chief utility was as picnic tables when we ate lunch outside. Now all of this became a living place, a treasure site, a lava pit of intoxicating emotions I'd never experienced before. That flint gateway had been the entrance to a vast enclosure of monastic lands, granaries, dairies, bakeries, storehouses, stables, byres, pigsties, fishponds, forges, workplaces. That Protestant pile had been a Benedictine abbey, where 1,000 years before, on any afternoon, I could have heard exactly the same soaring chant of vespers I'd heard on my first afternoon at Corps. The foundation of St. Albans Abbey came on the upswing of a mighty sea change in the era fatuously dubbed, during the Dark Age of Queen Victoria, the Dark Ages. A time when men and women of good sense must have been in a tumult of excited hope as a great reforming king reached his life's goal, a unified Europe. An entity transcending tribal, national, and dynastic ambitions, stretching from the North Sea to the Pyrenees, from Italy to the Atlantic, one and at peace, centuries before the brutal idiocies of patriotism tore it into bloodier and bloodier shreds. The first Holy Roman Emperor, Charlemagne, a ruler known not, as most rulers are, for his skill at mass murder, but for his restraint and deep respect for learning, notably that of a man he called Master, leader of a great intellectual revival at the imperial court in Aachen, the English Benedictine, Alcuin of York. I acquired a duffel coat that autumn, one of those shapeless felt things, with a large hood and wide sleeves to accommodate thick existentialist sweaters. I took to gliding round the abbey precincts and the abbey itself after school, with the hood up and my hands tucked together in the sleeve, in a rough approximation of monastic garb, conjuring up the occasion when Alcuin himself came all the way from Aachen to see how the work was going, with me as his guide, or being some good brother on exactly this day of this month and this time of the evening in, say, 1156, padding round the cloister, dreaming of a nice fish dinner from the fish pond at the bottom of the hill. One early afternoon, when the abbey was empty of visitors, I stood in the choir and sang a few phrases of Gregorian chant I'd picked up. The plangent notes rose into the cold darkness of the chancel arches and echoed along the old stones of the nave, separate from me and yet still my voice, stirring the ghosts of a millennium. Unfortunately, my duffel coat was fawn-coloured, so rather than looking monastic, I probably struck anyone who bothered to notice as a seriously strange kid who stood in strange places for strangely extended periods. But inside my hood, I was a man in black, centuries gone, lost on a sea of time. For the new identity, the non-craze, the one that had stuck, was monk. More than a year it had been now, long enough for 20 crazes to have been born and died, and this one had survived. I was a teenage monk. My school pals were deciding whether their musical allegiance should be to Chuck Berry or Dave Brubeck. My musical hero was a 6th-century pope named Gregory the Great. To them, Peter, Paul, and Mary meant folk. To me, it meant the top two apostles and the mother of Christ. Other guys were groping girls in cars. I, who had had a torrid affair with a married woman, had renounced the world and its fleshpots. They were eyeing the emerging schism between mod and rocker, and wondering which way to jump in the crucial matter of hair. I couldn't wait to shave a bald spot in mine. Since my first Easter at Core, almost a year before by now, there had been many contacts with Father Joe, other visits, a flow of letters. All broadened and deepened my sense of certainty, of a world which hung together intellectually and spiritually. I got to know every emotional way station of the long trip down to the Isle of Wight. The fidgety excitement at setting out, the monastic detachment as I jostled with London's millions in the underground, the anticipatory crossfade from the city's hideous southern rim to the suburban greenery of Surrey and the soft downs of Sussex, the feeling of leaving the world behind entirely as I set out across the Solent on the ferry, the renewed excitement as we neared the shore and there was the Abbey's gnome hat minaret sticking out of the oaks. And always that squeak of sandal on linoleum, the swish of robes outside in the corridor, the knock, the funny, bony face poking round the door, the catalyst and exemplar and still centre of my transformation. There was Father Joe sitting in a field in July, sweating rivers in his robes, but transported, granny glasses intent on a cornflower, his knobbly digit caressing its petals. "Everything we need to know is here, Tony dear. God's love for us, that he surrounds us with such beauty. God's love for his creation, his beautiful cornflower. Beauty that existed for eons, just for God, long before we came along. Beauty for its own sake, in idipsum. Order and harmony. Look at the blue of those petals, dear.
exactly the blue of the summer sky.
He held it up to the sky, and he was right.
How could such beauty exist without God? There would be nothing, surely.
And I thought, everything I need to know is here indeed. The delighted eyes squinting through ancient lenses, the giant twitching nose with its unclipped hairs, the elastic lips stretched in ecstasy at the little round of sky in his fingers. This is what I had to become, this clear, this simple, this present and alive. There was Father Joe the Mischievous, admitting that he could get irked by the Psalms.
We have to say all 150 of them every week, you see. Of course they're wonderful, and they shape our lives, but that old psalmist, golly, he can be a grump.
Oh, Lord, I'm so depressed this morning. Nobody loves me, and besides, I have boils. Hear my voice from the depths, O Lord, and please do something about these boils.
Amen. Or that he'd sneaked an extra helping of pudding from the kitchen after supper, a fairly large Rule of St. Benedict no-no, or overlooked a prank played by a novice because he thought it was funny. All these transgressions accompanied by,
don't tell the abbot.
There was Father Joe expounding the meaning of contemptus mundi, literally contempt for the world, a phrase I was much enamored of, with that great, uncompromising absolute.
But does contemptus mean contempt, dear? Of course not. That would imply arrogance, superiority, pride. So much that we call worldly is actually just flawed, or being seen through a cracked lens, imperfect or imperfectly understood. Who are we to judge as contemptible a thing or person whose existence God sustains? Everything, however imperfect, has its purpose. No, Tony dear, contemptus mundi means detachment from the world, seeing the world sub specie eternitatis, enduring or celebrating it, but never forgetting, even when it seems perfect and forever, that as the Bible says, all this shall pass like grass before the wind.
There was Father Joe's retort in answer to some enthusiastic piety of mine about the sanctity of the community and its high purpose.
Good gracious, dear, we're not silly old monks mumbling prayers all day long. We've got a job to do.
And my laughing but a bit startled, too, until I realized how like him this was, how unpious, how down-to-earth, encapsulating his immensely generous view